What is it that you need when your back's against the wall, when you're between a rock and a hard place, down in the corner with seemingly nowhere to turn? Those kinds of moments, what is it that you need? We're going to look at some people this morning that find themselves in that kind of a situation. Backs against the wall, between the rock and the hard place, down in the corner, and where do we turn? We're going to see in that moment what was their greatest need and how that need could be met. Last time as I was with you, we looked at Matthew 8 and 9, and we said three cycles that occur there, three challenges of discipleship. The cycle consists of miracles that Jesus performed, and then that gets concluded with the challenge of discipleship. And three times over, that cycle occurs in Matthew's Gospel, chapters 8 and 9. We looked at the first challenge. We said the way of discipleship is demanding. There were kind of twofold emphasis that comes in that first challenge, and Jesus says it is demanding, so weigh it carefully. Consider what's involved. It's a serious proposition, so take your time. But in that same challenge, he mentions that the way of discipleship is also a matter of urgent priority. And so we left off with that that line to help us remember, the way of discipleship is demanding, so take your time, but hurry. We said if that was the only challenge that we had, we'd walk out the door very much aware of the onerous task of discipleship, but how do we do it? How do we measure up? Who is sufficient for these things? And so then we have the second challenge. And the way of discipleship is rooted in grace, and it is sustained in grace. It's God's enabling that enables us to live the life of discipleship. Those were the first two challenges. This morning we want to look at the third challenge, and we're going to do that by way of a focus on the title, Would You Lend Me a Hand? In each of these challenges of discipleship, as I mentioned, they're preceded with the miracles, a series of miracles that the Lord performs. We didn't have time to look at the miracles plus the challenge, but an understanding of those miracles need to help inform us because they do impact on the nature of the challenge. So this morning, I'd like to go back and read the whole section, the miracles and the challenge. And then we're going to look at the first two miracles. Don't have time to look at them all, but we'll look at the first two, which will kind of serve as representative of the four. And then we'll look at the discipleship challenge itself. We'll look at those miracles, those first two miracles, in a little different way of a third-person narrative, and then we will focus on the discipleship challenge. So if we're up for that, that's where we're going to go. Let's jump in, verse 18, Matthew 9. While he, that is Jesus, was saying these things to them, behold, a ruler came in and knelt before him, saying, my daughter has just died. Mark, as he records this, he says that she's at the point of death. The nuance there is that she's as good as dead. My daughter has just died. My daughter's at the point of death. But come and lay your hand on her, and she will live. And Jesus rose and followed him with his disciples. And behold, a woman who had suffered from a discharge of blood for 12 years came up behind him and touched the fringe of his garment. For she said to herself, if I only touch his garment, I will be made well. Jesus turned, and seeing her, he said, take heart, daughter, your faith has made you well. And instantly the woman was made well. When Jesus came to the ruler's house and saw the flute players and the crowd making a commotion, he said, go away, for the girl is not dead, but sleeping. And they laughed at him. But when the crowd had been put outside, he went in and took her by the hand, and the girl arose. And the report of this went through all that district. And as Jesus passed on from there, two blind men followed him, saying aloud, have mercy on us, son of David. When he entered the house, the blind men came to him, and Jesus said to them, do you believe that I'm able to do this? They said to him, yes, Lord. Then he touched their eyes, saying, "According to your faith, be it done to you." And their eyes were opened, and Jesus sternly warned them, "See that no one knows about it." But they went away and spread his fame through all that district. As they were going away, behold, a demon-oppressed man who was mute was brought to him. And when the demon had been cast out, the mute man spoke. And the crowds marveled, saying, "Never was anything like this seen in Israel." But the Pharisees said, "He casts out demons by the prince of demons." And Jesus went throughout all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every disease and every affliction. When he saw the crowds, he had compassion for them, because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. Then he said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, pray earnestly to the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest." The word of the Lord. He found himself in a hard and difficult moment. 12 years ago, he never would have dreamt being in this kind of a moment. 12 years ago, he dreamt. He had dreams, because after all, what father doesn't have dreams for his kids? Seems like just yesterday, that moment of excitement when his wife gave birth, and for the first time he heard those words, "She's a girl." He remembers holding her in his arms for the first time as she christened that blanket that his wife had carefully and skillfully crafted. He looked into her face, eyeing her every feature. I mean, it was just pure joy. While she would not be the Messiah, that much was evident. After all, she was a girl. And while it wouldn't fall to her to look after her mom and dad in their old age, there was nevertheless no disappointment in this father's eyes. Because after all, when it comes to children, there's nothing quite like a bond that a dad has with his girls. The blur of the last 12 years has done nothing to weaken that bond, only strengthen it. And it's never been stronger than this moment. The bond has never been stronger, but tragically, the dream had never been weaker for this young girl, now turned young woman. This one who just a few short days ago had all the energy and vitality of a typical 12-year-old, she now lies lifeless, knocking on death's door. What's a dad supposed to do in a moment like that? Well, a dad, like any dad in his role of provider and protector before the crisis comes, he just wants to fix it. But sometimes when your back's against the wall and you're between a rock and a hard place, down in the corner with nowhere to turn, you can't fix it. And that's when you discover what you really need. This dad can think of only one place where potential help might be found. It's with the renegade rabbi. Oh, not that he considers him a renegade, but others in the region, they think he's a renegade. The religious leaders have determined that he's a renegade, and they've just made their evaluation public. The religious establishment think on this matter, their opinion is the only one that counts. But the religious establishment doesn't speak for everyone. And it doesn't speak for this dad. Except, this dad works for the religious establishment. He works for the religious leaders. Being responsible for the order and the progress of worship at the synagogue is just part of the job description. And getting to live in the house adjacent to the synagogue is, well, it's not a bad part of the deal. Talk about being caught between a rock and a hard place. In this kind of a situation, what's a dad supposed to do? On the one hand, employment is important. Having a place to live is necessary. But on the other hand, here's his pride and joy daughter staring death in the face. Vocational implications are one thing. Living without your daughter is quite another. So you look at it from that perspective, the risk of the choice that's facing this dad is really not that difficult. Seeking out the renegade rabbi, however, it's not just a matter of being pragmatic. It's not just a matter of convenience. It runs deeper than that. I mean, the religious establishment has cast their vote. It's time for this dad to cast his. And as he thinks about that, there's a thought that goes through his mind and says, what are the odds that this rabbi who's already on the outs with the religious establishment will look kindly on me, one who works for the establishment? That kind of reasoning seems to make sense. From all the external appearances, one would conclude that one who works for the religious establishment would be firmly in the back pocket of the religious leaders. Who knows what the odds are? But it's time to find out. The worst that can happen is that he gets kicked when he's down. Or the best that could happen is that he actually gets what he needs. And so with knee bowed and a heart filled with worship for the rabbi, he expresses that even though his little girl is near unto death, he believes that if this teacher would just lend a hand, she'd live. Translated, that means, hey, rabbi, would you lend me a hand? No sooner had his vote been cast and his question asked, when this dad, with heart racing, newfound energy because of the adrenaline rush, is now official tour guide, leading Jesus and his cadre of followers on the shortest route back to his house, to the synagogue parsonage. All the while he's thinking to himself, how fortunate am I that this one would look at me for who I really am and not how others might perceive me and be willing to help me in the moment of my greatest need. But fortune's a strange thing. Oh, not that we believe in fortune, but I mean even providence is wrapped in mystery. Circumstances can change so quickly. They can turn on a shekel, they can turn on a dime. It doesn't take much. And it seems that for this anxious dad, who now has an extra spring in his step, it's as if he trips in midair, and his newfound joy comes crashing down. But fortune turns to misfortune. As Jesus already knew, and as this anxious dad was about to find out, there was no shortage of crisis-filled people in the region. No shortage of people whose backs were against the wall, between a rock and a hard place, down in the corner with seemingly nowhere to turn. No shortage of these kinds of people. And seemingly on this day, the rabbi had time for them all. But time from this dad's perspective is in short supply. There's no time for delay. In that kind of a moment, what's a dad supposed to do? He does what any dad should do. He bites his tongue, and he waits, and he watches. He'll watch to see if others in their moment of crisis have the same need as he. Oh, he sensed that nobody was following him, and he turns around, and back in the short distance, there's a crowd that's gathered around the Messiah. Around the rabbi. He takes a few steps, he gets a little closer, he stops, he blinks, he looks again, but no, he was right the first time. It really was a woman occupying center stage. Imagine that. A woman in his culture, occupying center stage and garnering the attention of the rabbi. A woman with her own personal crisis. A woman whose back was against the wall, between the rock and the hard place, down in the corner and wondering where she could turn. She's a woman with, well, how do you say it politely? She was a woman with a medical problem, a condition that not too many people were willing to talk about. Openly, that is. I mean, they talked about it, just not when she was around. with her medical condition. People tried to avoid her. Even though at this time she's surrounded with a crowd of people, it really does seem that she's alone. Well, being alone is nothing new for her. She's kind of gotten used to that. People tried not being around her. Despite how well she tried to look after herself, quite honestly, on a day like this, with the great penetrating heat of the Middle Eastern sun and surrounded by a crowd of people, you probably smelled her before you saw her. People tried not having contact with her. They tried to avoid her because to have contact with her meant that you would be ceremonially unclean just as she was. That meant you'd never share a meal together. And she wasn't welcome at the place of worship. If and when the ladies ever got together, there would be no invitation for her. If her problem began at puberty, then she was probably never a candidate for marriage. If her condition afflicted her after she was married, then marriage probably for her is something that she speaks of in terms of the past tense. Because in all probability, the marriage would have dissolved when she was no longer able to bear children. Little wonder that she's alone. That seemingly has been her assignment in life, to be alone. She doesn't like being alone. In fact, she's taken all of her resources and tried to find treatment to make her well so that she didn't have to bear the isolation of being alone, but all to no avail. And so here she is. And she musters up all the strength she can in her weakened condition. She is weak, you can tell that. Because after all, when you're continually losing blood, you not only lose your blood, you lose your energy. She gathers up all her energy and a whole lot of courage to be in this crowd of people, even though nobody in that crowd wants her to be there. Somehow she's heard the reports. Maybe even from a distance or two, she's seen a miracle or two of his. And the faith of this ostracized, despised woman has brought her to this place that she believes that if she can just get close enough to the rabbi, if she could just touch the tassels of his prayer shawl garment, that the rabbi would be able to do for her what modern medicine had been unable to. In her mind, the question is, hey, Rabbi, would you lend me a hand? And as she thought about her actions, she thinks to herself, but what's the likelihood that the rabbi would overstep Jewish tradition and would allow a woman to occupy center stage even for a moment or two, let alone an ostracized, despised woman like me? But it's time to find out. And find out she did. Because Jesus turned and seeing her, he says, take heart, daughter. Your faith has made you well. And instantly, the woman was made well. She was made whole. Made well physically. Made well emotionally. Made well spiritually. In that moment, she was made whole. She came to him with a dream, just with a question. Hey, Rabbi, would you lend me a hand? In those moments that have passed, on one hand, it seemed that time has stood still for this anxious dad. Well, what had transpired was not lost on him. He had taken it all in. His observation confirmed his suspicion that other people in their moment of crisis had the same need as he. He was thankful for the visual. He was glad for the object lesson, but it was hard for him to flush the thought. I wish it hadn't taken so long, because he still had a crisis at home. But what was obviously a divine interruption, after that, the journey continues. He leads Jesus and his followers en route to his house. And as they arrive at their house, what confronts them conveys to any onlooker that tragically they're too late. Oh, that they were too late was apparent before they ever got there because of all the noise. I mean, there was the wailing, there was the moaning, there was the crying, there was the anguish. Professional mourners, of course, are good at that. And that noise could be heard all over. And before Jesus and his cadre of followers would have ever turned down that street, they would have heard the noise. Ah, fortune's a strange thing. Not that we believe in fortune, but even providence is wrapped in mystery. Circumstances can change so quick, turn on a shekel, or they can turn on a dime. And just a matter of hours, this anxious dad has been down and up like a yo-yo. Down, up, down, up, down. There was his daughter staring death in the face, is down. But the rabbi seemingly is willing to help. It's up. But en route, they get interrupted with this woman in her crisis, and there's delay. It's down. The journey resumes quickly. It's up. But they arrive at the house. It's too late. And it's down. Emotionally, it's taken its toll. You would forgive this dad if he might have said to himself, I wished we hadn't stopped for that woman. There might have been time. As the mourners, the family members, and friends try to console this grieving dad, there's a ray of light that pierces into the dark moment. And Jesus tells the people to get away and declares that the girl, well, she's not dead, but she's merely asleep. Ah, such a diagnosis is laughable. Except for an anxious dad who dearly longs for it to be true. But I mean, some of these are professional mourners. They've been to a funeral or two. Like they know when someone's dead. What kind of perverse tease is it for a religious leader to tell a grieving dad that his daughter is merely asleep when in fact she's dead? I mean, who would do that? Well, a renegade rabbi who's in the region trying to make a name for himself, I suppose, he might do that. Or one who is the Messiah, the one who knows what you need the most in those moments of crisis. When your back's against the wall, when you're between the rock and the hard place, down in the corner with nowhere to go, the one who not only knows what your greatest need is, but the one who's able to meet that need. He might do that. And so when the skeptics, the detractors, the unbelievers are put outside, Jesus does the unthinkable. And the question that this anxious dad has had all along is, hey, Rabbi, would you lend me a hand? And that question is about to ultimately get answered. And Jesus, the rabbi, the Messiah, his hand goes out. And with outstretched hand, this girl comes to life. She arose. And the impossible happens. And the girl lives. And for this dad, so does his dream. Because Jesus met them in the moment of their greatest need and gave them that which they needed the most. And Jesus, this morning, he challenges his disciples, he challenges his followers, the likes of you and me, for us to meet people in their moment of need and give to them that which they need the most. But how do we do that? And that's the challenge of this third discipleship lesson. Verse 36 in our text tells us that when Jesus looked on the crowds, he was filled with compassion. Well, what would the compassion of Jesus look like? Well, He's just shown us what his compassion looks like. We see his compassion as he deals with this anxious dad and his dying daughter. We see his compassion as he deals with the woman with the bleeding condition. We see his compassion as he deals with the two blind people and then with the demonized person who's unable to speak. That's what his compassion looks like. He was moved with compassion as he saw the crowd. He was moved in the innermost part of his being with deep feelings of affection. He was moved like that because he saw people with and in their deepest need. Physical needs for sure. It's hard not to see a dying person and not see a need. It's hard to see a person constantly losing blood and not see a need. Hard to see two blind people not be aware that there's a need. Hard to see someone who's unable to speak and not sense that there's a need. Jesus saw their physical needs. But when he saw them, he saw more than that. When Jesus saw these people, because of the greatness of their need, our text says that he saw them as sheep without a shepherd. Now, when we see that expression, sheep without a shepherd, we ought not to have the picture in our mind of a nice, neat little fenced-in 40-acre farm with sheep there, complete with the security of a llama or two to look after them. Sheep without a shepherd in these days. You saw a band of sheep without a shepherd and without his dog. As one has said, that's a picture of sheep eating and nibbling their way into danger and death, eating their way into deep pits and over sharp cliffs. Sheep without a shepherd here is referring to the leaders in Israel's day. Sheep without a shepherd were God's people being abandoned by their leaders. Life was difficult for the people. They were living under the oppression of the Roman Empire, who was occupying their territory. And that was bad, but beyond that, in addition to that, the religious leaders were not fulfilling their responsibilities to their people, were not looking after the most important needs of their people, not caring spiritually for the people. Recent events in the life of the ministry of Jesus have just served to underscore that. Jesus has come among his people. He's performed these amazing miracles. And while his support among the rank and file people, the ordinary folks, has soared, not so among these religious leaders. These religious leaders who are more concerned about their own turf, fearing that they were going to lose their power, they've lined up in opposition against this one. And Jesus, while these things that he has done, these miracles, calming the storms, raising the dead, casting out demons, he's demonstrated that these needs are very great. And while all these needs have been great, the emphasis of Jesus' ministry, it's permeated his ministry, is that the needs of this nation, the needs of these people, is greater than that. The greatest need is the problem of sin. The greater need for the paralytic, the greater need for the tax collectors, the greater need for even the religious leaders. It's internal. It's not external. It's the problem of sin. And Jesus will deal with that problem as he will ultimately lay down his life on the cross, just as Isaiah the prophet had earlier predicted. The downfall of these leaders in this day was twofold. They were not giving proper care to the most important spiritual needs of the people. And in addition, they have lined themselves up in opposition to the very one who came to meet that need. And when Jesus looked out on the crowd and saw them, the greatness of their need, he saw sheep without a shepherd. But not only that, the text says that he saw a great harvest. I saw a harvest that was great. The metaphor changes, but the underscoring need remains the same. When Jesus saw these people, he saw a great harvest. A harvest consisting of a great crowd of people but with an enormous need. And when Jesus saw that, he was moved with compassion, deeply moved in the innermost part of his being. When he saw these people spiritually, their backs against the wall, between a rock and a hard place, seemingly nowhere to turn, he wanted to give them that which they needed the most. And so to his disciples and to his followers, he says this, the harvest is plentiful, the workers are few. Translated, that means, hey disciples, would you lend me a hand? Would you give me a hand so that your hand becomes my hands? Would you give me your hands so that your hands become my hands in helping to meet the greatest needs of these people? Give me your hands so that your hands become my hands in meeting the need that they have the most. But there's something that needs to happen even before that. Before our hands can become his hands, his eyes need to become our eyes. We need to see people as he sees people. Physical needs for sure, temporal needs for sure, but Jesus looks at people. He doesn't see them in terms of their wealth, not in terms of their status, not in terms of their position, not in terms of their vocation. He sees them in terms of their need before him. He wants us, as his followers, as his disciples, to see people as he sees them. Whether that's our neighbor who may be the ideal neighbor who would do anything for us, or whether that's our colleague at work who stretches the limits of tolerance, he wants us to see people in terms of their need before God. Because when we see people as he sees people, his compassion will become our compassion. And then we'll be willing to let our hands be his hands. Because what people need the most when spiritually, their backs are against the wall, caught between the rock and the hard place, down in the corner with nowhere to turn, what they need is a hand up through a handout. A hand outstretched with God's compassion, an offer of grace to meet their deepest need. And that's how he builds his kingdom. Because discipleship happens when his eyes become our eyes and our hands become his hands. Father, will you help that to be our experience this week?